Hello, and welcome to Lopes on Movies. My name is Joey Lopes, and today I am joined by Connor.
Hello.
Hey, Connor, how you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing okay.
That's it? Nothing else?
Yeah, I'm fine. I've been hanging out on the beach. I've been Lewis, you know, just enjoying getting some sun. You know, that's what I've been doing.
Yeah, fun in the sun, you know.
Yeah, I don't know anything about what's been going on at all, just like disconnecting. It's been kind of nice, you know.
Yeah, you've definitely been kind of out of the loop for at least like a week and a half, it feels like. So by the time you return to society, I can promise you everything has changed.
Yeah,
the world is a completely different place than it was last week.
Do we have good news on Avatar 2?
Well, it's funny you should mention that. So we'll start this episode with just a little bit of movie news, as we do every now and then. And as Connor alluded to, I have some very sad news for everybody listening to this. Unfortunately, Avatar 2, the sequel to the 2009 hit James Cameron film Avatar, has been delayed again. It's now been pushed back to December 22nd, 2022. So I mean, I don't know what I can say about this one, guys. I'm taking this one pretty hard.
Yeah, I mean, me too. Of all the things that coronavirus has done, this has got to be at least the. I can't even say that. It's like totally like I'm sure he blamed it on the coronavirus, but like they're not. Yeah. This movie's not getting made. Yeah, like, are you kidding me?
The coronavirus is what delayed Avatar 2. So this is the seventh time Avatar 2 has been delayed. It was originally planned to be finished in 2014 and released in 2014. And, like, every, you know, year it would get pushed back another year or two every now and then until finally today when, you know, it was just a matter of time, really. Like, I don't think anybody actually expected that release date of 2021 or whatever to stick. There's a good article by Mark Harris on Vulture.com about this. He's been like tweeting about the anniversary of the original release date for Avatar 2, like every year that it's passed. And so he's been following this saga for a while. So I recommend checking that out. And basically, what he's trying to do is figure out like what's going on in James Cameron's head. Like, why is this happening? Why is Avatar 2 continually getting delayed? Like, yeah, we can blame the coronavirus for these delays, and that might have had some impact. But the fact is, this is the seventh time Avatar 2 has been delayed. So there must be something else going on here. Personally, I think it's probably just hubris. I mean, I think James Cameron is trying to both one-up himself and one-up both Star Wars and Marvel and beat them at their own game by creating his own movie franchise that, you know, ends up being bigger and better. But the problem is that I don't think anybody still cares about Avatar or even wants these movies. So he really has an uphill battle here, and it seems like he's kind of shying away from the reality that at some point he's going to have to actually release this.
Do you think that it's just that they like why don't they just say this is done? Like, we're not making this. Like, there's people that are working on this.
Oh, yeah, still. Yeah. Yeah, I know people
like
that are working on it.
Right, which is fascinating, though, and it just keeps going, but, like, it's like this unwritten thing that everybody knows, or unspoken, that everybody knows this isn't happening, but yet
the funny
it just
thing,
keeps
too,
going.
Is that it's not even just Avatar 2, because if you remember, this Avatar 2 has ballooned into, like, you know, four movies, or three movies, or whatever it is. Now it's like Avatar 2, 3, and 4. Maybe Avatar 5 also. I can't even follow it anymore. It's getting ridiculous. But the They even announced release dates for the last one in the Avatar series. Allegedly, that's coming out in December 2028.
Good. I'll mark my calendar.
Can you imagine that? Seriously, like putting out a release date 8 years in advance for a movie?
The movie
industry is a funny place these days.
This is Disney, right?
It's kind of Disney, kind of not. I think Disney has some stake in Avatar, but I don't think it's just Disney. I think it was a Fox thing that kind of ended up getting subsumed into Disney. I mean, really, it just seems like it's James Cameron doing whatever he wants, getting written a blank check to, you know, just keep everybody employed on this project.
He's financing this? No.
No, he's not. I don't think he's financing it.
So
but
what's
he's
why
in
does
charge,
the studio
you know?
Just not, like, say no? Like, this is not happening. Like,
I mean, stop. How do you say no to James Cameron?
I mean, I guess that's it.
If you think about it, like
the great James Cameron.
Well, not just anger him, but I mean, even though this is clearly like a case of an auteur run amok, which is something I wholly endorse, by the way. Even though this is clearly a case of that, you got to remember that James Cameron is like the most successful filmmaker of all time. You know, he's one-upped himself twice on putting out the most profitable movie in history.
Yeah, so, in very different genres too. Like he's done it, which is the pretty interesting thing. I mean, he's a great filmmaker, no doubt. Like it's just this is not. I didn't love Avatar. It was fine.
It hasn't aged well in terms of people's
now, right?
Like memories of it. Like it was obviously like a huge jolt when it first came out, but now when anybody talks about Avatar, they kind of talk about it like, yeah, the story's not very good, but the 3D was cool, you know, and that's pretty much like. Avatar's
now the 3D
legacy.
Is starting to not look that cool.
Yeah, so
because it's
know.
Getting old. So this thing is going to have very little to stand on now. The story is just, yeah, you're right. It's very old for a movie that came out not that long ago, I guess.
Yeah. Well, here's what I'll say. James Cameron, I'm rooting for you. I hope, you know, at some point you swallow your pride and decide to just, you know, be finished with this movie and put it out there for people to see and, you know, maybe people will like it. You know, like, hey, never doubt Cameron, right? Right? That's the way it goes.
Okay.
Maybe we should doubt Cameron at this point. All right. Let's talk about what we really want to talk about on this this Lofs on Movies episode. So, in keeping with our tradition of watching old movies, we decided to watch this week a classic film from 1964. This is the first Beatles movie, A Hard Day's Night, and there's a couple of reasons why we chose this movie to watch this week. But Connor, we watched A Hard Day's Night. What do you think?
I think that there's a very very specific reason why we picked A Hard Day's Night.
Well, yeah. I hate to shill myself on the radio, but
no,
at the same time, I don't hate to shill myself on the radio. Everybody, please go to my YouTube channel.
Yes.
No, so I recently completed a project I've been working on for like the past couple of months where I recreated every guitar solo section from every Beatles song. So that's like 76 guitar solos that like I played every instrument except the drums and made a video on YouTube where I play all the guitar solos. Incredible amount of work. I did this because if some of you might be aware, if you've been listening to the show for a while, that I play in a band that does this Beatle Fest project every year that was canceled this year because of the coronavirus. But the gist of the project is that over the course of 6 nights we play every Beatles song. So it would have happened this year, but of course, because of COVID-19, it did not. So I kind of felt like doing something else Beatles-related, and that kind of resulted in this ridiculous project. So if you're curious about this and you like the Beatles, you know, maybe search up the video title is "I Play Every Beatles Guitar Solo," and the YouTube channel is Jalopes TL or JALOPESTL, That is it for this self-endorsement.
Yeah, no, it is actually, you know, all jokes aside, it's actually really great. It's totally, I don't know if anyone's attempted something like that before, where every single part is completely recreated with musicians. Like, you got people to come in to play the drums for you, and then you played all the guitar parts, and I mean, it's, you even did, like, there's some vocal tracks here and there for when it's in it for the solo, and... You can even hear A Hard Day's Night, all the solos from that album.
It's true. You can. And there's some very very great solos on that album. Yeah, let me tell you. So A Hard Day's Night. Yeah, we watched this because, you know, I did this Beatles project. But I think there's kind of a stigma against movies like this that's really existed forever, right? Like, the idea being like, okay, this is a media tie-in, right? Like, the Beatles were really big at some point, and then some movie producer was like, let's cash in on this, put them in a movie, they make a bunch of money, right? And this was a tradition that had been happening for years before A Hard Day's Night had ever come out, right? Like, where Elvis used to like be in a bunch of really garbage movies, right? So when you when you talk about like this with people that are not aware of the movie, their first thought is probably like, why would I watch a movie that's just like a movie starring the Beatles? That sounds kind of like cheesy and, you know, probably not very good. But people that are familiar with A Hard Day's Night will tell you, no, that's not what this is. This is actually a very historically significant movie that not only was a huge commercial success when it came out, but was critically acclaimed at the time as well. And is actually like a really, really important movie in like the history of history of movies and the history of just like pop culture. So it's something that it requires a little bit of context to understand why it's important to watch it. But really, that's the gist of it. So the basic synopsis of the movie, it's a fictional movie. It's not a documentary. It is a fictional movie that kind of fictionalizes the like 2 days in the life of the Beatles, right? And the idea is like the boys are struggling to keep themselves and Paul McCartney's mischievous grandfather in check while they're preparing for a live television performance, right? Like that's the basic idea. And it was directed by Richard Lester, written by Alan Owen, and produced by Walter Shenson. And of course, it stars, you know, the Beatles, John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, Ringo Starr. And yeah, so I think the important thing to keep in mind here is that A Hard Day's Night is not just a cynical media tie-in. By all accounts, it should have been that. But what this ended up being is actually a very unusual and kind of subversive movie. Not really unlike how the Beatles themselves were a very unusual pop act for the time, and it's the reason why they were so revolutionary. So let's just try to dive into this a little bit. Like, what makes this movie special? So, Connor, this is the first time you've ever seen this movie, correct?
It is, yeah. So I mean, I've seen clips from it because there's so many Beatles documentaries and things out there. So I've seen clips, but not the movie itself. Because there's, you know, the movie has sections where it's like a music video of them playing the songs and stuff. No, it's great. And the thing that's it isn't just a cheap thing. There's really inventive camera work and lighting. Like there's one scene that I remember like vividly. Where I remember the lighting being incredible. It was for the song, when they do the song, And I Love Her.
I'm glad you brought that up, yeah.
And the lighting is just incredible, and it's like, this is very impressive.
Yeah,
and,
there's that iconic shot that kind of like 360 degrees around Paul McCartney that ends like a profile
shot. Yeah, that's
shot,
exactly
and the light
what I'm
is just like shining right at the camera.
Right, yeah. It's like, but that's not the only one of those. This is throughout the entire thing. And there's a loose story that's actually really fun. With Paul McCartney's grandfather, who's just this like crazy like kind of goofy guy who's just trying to, you don't really know what he's after.
Just
he's just
troublemaker.
Trying to like he's just a troublemaker kind of guy too. And then it's kind of like a coming of age story for Ringo. It kind of like he kind of gets mocked and stuff for seemingly no reason, but like he's like not the one who's as outgoing as the others. So it's kind of like he. There's a whole section where he goes off on his own and kind of finds himself or something, but not really. It's just fun. It really is. And it's a great way to like get all the songs out there too. And they kind of tie in nicely. Instruments just kind of show up and they play them in certain sections, but it works. Like you're not like, oh, that's weird. You know, but it's good. And they're all for non-actors. They all do a very good job, I would say.
Yeah, of course. I love this movie, obviously. I think, like, this is a perfect example of why I always say, like, I think the Beatles will always be cool. And, like, this movie does a great job demonstrating why that is. I think the music is, and, like, the performance scenes are obviously what kind of, like, hold this thing together. But what really makes the movie greater than just that whole, like, cynical media tie-in is, like, the band translated seemingly so effortlessly into essentially, like, a comedy troupe format.
Right.
Like the producer Walter Shenson I mentioned earlier, he described meeting them for the first time. Like it was him, their manager Brian Epstein, and then the four Beatles like crammed into the small taxi. And he said it was like being like a Marx Brothers comedy. Like they're all like one upping each other with just like one liners, like right off the bat, right? So they had this kind of like natural humor to them that ended up being just like a perfect thing to translate into a comedy movie. So it really just kind of took that natural humor and exaggerated it almost to like Monty Python like level of stuff. So it's this movie about like four larger than life goons that are like making a mockery of like everything about polite society but they're nonetheless coming together to put on like show-stopping musical performances. So it's a formula that seems so obvious now in hindsight, but it really could never have worked with anyone but those four guys, because they just have this perfect chemistry and this perfect like humorous dynamic. And there actually were like very many imitators of A Hard Day's Night after it came out, obviously with other bands like Herman's Hermits and Dave Clark Five. But you know, there's a reason why we don't talk about those movies and we're still talking about A Hard Day's Night.
I wonder if a lot of people's impressions of the Beatles come from these movies. Like I guess, like, if you're someone who saw this back then, you kind of get, this is what you think that they're like also.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Yeah, I think this movie is what really introduced people to each of the four band members as, like, individual people. And it honestly is a huge part of the Beatles, like, kind of legend and mythos surrounding them, honestly. Like, I think like I said, their music is the thing that is, you know, the most important. It's obviously, like, the Beatles were a band. But the thing that really endeared the world to them was getting to know them as people and seeing, like, the thing that was so cool about the Beatles is that when they came out, like, it didn't seem like there was any facade, right? They just seemed like a group of four guys that happened to hit it big, right? And you can see this in tons of interviews that they used to do with press at the time. Like, there's plenty of interviews on YouTube you can find where, like, they didn't take anything seriously. Like, they'd be asked questions and they'd just be like dunking on the interviewer for like,
yeah, there's one scene of that too where they're doing exactly that.
Yeah, like, exactly. And that was apparently like based very heavily on just stuff they actually said to reporters. Like, it wasn't just something that that they wrote in the script. It was like, this is stuff that the Beatles just did routinely, right?
Yeah.
So you always got the sense that what you were seeing was actually them, and this movie just kind of elevated
that.
But
they do it in not in like a nasty way. They just do it in like kind of a funny way, like goofy. There's one part in the film where Paul McCartney is answering every single question like, oh no, we're just friends. Like, they're asking like a question about his father and he's like, oh, actually no, we're really just friends. It's like,
or the reporter asking George funny. Harrison, you know, has fame changed your life in any way, and he's like, yes.
Yeah, but that the funny thing about that too is if you watch any interview with George Harrison, that's exactly how he is. He seems very like not like comfortable really in interviews as much as the rest of them. But that would be exactly how he is.
I mean, of course, John Lennon is the funniest one.
Well, but that's the thing. I never had that was the most stark thing for me is that I never got that impression of John, because I see lots of John clips and a lot of them are from his post Beatles days.
Sure.
Like in like all the music videos of him in New York and Central Park and in Battery Park City and everything, taking the music videos for those songs. And he never struck me as such a person with so much personality he is in this. Like, it seems a little bit over the top, but I don't know. Maybe he was that way, especially when he was younger. He got, like, really serious, too, I thought. But
well, allegedly, yeah, like John was, like, probably one of the funnier, just, like, naturally funny Beatles members. Like, they all were, but, like, I feel like when you look at those, like, old interviews, like, half the time it's John saying something stupid to interviewers and confusing them. Like
this one, it's like way over the top.
Oh,
like
sure,
him playing in a bathtub. Like,
yeah, yeah, he's just like a complete goon in this.
Yeah, right.
Just almost like a troublemaker himself. He's like a chaos agent, you know.
Yes, yeah.
But it's something that you could kind of get the sense for when you watch some of those early interviews with him, and this was just taken to the next level. But yeah, John Lennon's personality is he was actually the one that allegedly like the director and like people involved in the production liked the most from an acting perspective. And Richard Lesser, the director, actually cast John in another movie like a couple of years later, just because he was such a natural actor. Like, actually a lot of people think the script for this movie, that like a whole lot of it was ad-libbed because of how it's structured. Like, there's so many just like one-liners and quips and things that seem like completely off the cuff. Like 95% of it was actually scripted that way. It just feels so natural. Yeah. But John Lennon,
I think John
apparently
did look
one
like
one of the few that actually did do a lot of ad libs.
John did look like the most natural actor.
I feel like it's him and Ringo.
Yeah, and Ringo's good too. Well, Ringo has to be good in this because there's a lot of scenes where Ringo's just on his own. Now, was a lot of it dubbed? Or was it all dubbed after?
I'm sure there was a lot of it that was. I mean, there's some
because
lines
I feel like I could see it.
It
looks good. Like it, you know, it totally works.
I mean, I think the one of the things that makes the movie kind of like special is that it's really not just a kind of boring, you know, day in the life of the Beatles. It's kind of, it has a very surreal edge to it. Like you mentioned, like there are scenes where, like, you know, like for example, one of the first musical segments of the movie is they're in the back of a train playing cards, and then suddenly they all have instruments in their hands and they're playing music, right? So it has these kind of like weird surreal touches where those, you know, the continuity doesn't really exist there, but the idea is like he wanted the, like Richard Lester, the director, he wanted the movie to have that kind of weird edge to it to kind of heighten the experience of it a little bit. Like one of the first scenes in the movie, some like, you know, stuffy old guy joins the same train car, like the same room as what the Beatles are in, and of course like they're all clowning on him the whole time. And then there's like a brief moment where like they leave the room they were in, and then like you see them running next to the train, like banging on the window, like, hey mister. Like George is like riding a bike or something, and then suddenly they're back inside the train, right? So it's like right off the bat, like it kind of gets you in the mindset of like, okay, this is going to be kind of a strange movie. And there's other like weird lines like that where like John Lennon seemingly like dissolving in a bathtub and then suddenly materializing outside of it. Like it's weird, but it keeps you on your toes, and that's part of the joy of it, I think.
It looked like they were having fun doing it too. They did a bunch of these. Like, do you know if there's any?
That's actually
any
a
history to that.
A funny. You mentioned that. I watched a lot of the making of like documentaries and stuff on the Blu-ray, because I have the Blu-ray for this, and it was just so fun to look into. Apparently, the producer Walter Shenson, again, he showed his mother like a rough cut of the movie, and like 5 minutes into it, like she turned to him and said, "You know, I think this movie is going to be really successful because it looks like they're having a lot of fun." And that's going to be infectious to the audience. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure, like, everybody says that the production was really great overall. Like, I think the Beatles were approached a couple of times at this point in their career about doing movies. Because, honestly, like, this movie was developed before they became, like, a worldwide phenomenon. Or at least the talks begun at that point. Like, they were really big in Britain. But it wasn't until, like, you know, they had Sullivan Show in America that they suddenly became, like, this huge worldwide thing. And I'm pretty sure they went on Ed Sullivan like right before filming for this started. So it was really kind of a perfect storm. But the idea was like the Beatles, they got a couple of offers to be in movies, but they didn't want it to be something that was just like those, you know, like those Elvis movies or those cheap tie-in things. They wanted to do something that was going to be actually interesting. And they clicked with Richard Lester, the director, immediately. And they kind of had like a similar idea of what they wanted the movie to be. So I think the end result was that like they were all on the same page and they were all having a great time like doing the kind of comedy movie that they wanted to do. And like I said, I mean, the Beatles were like they themselves had a lot of personality and all the crazy like huge sense of humor. So I think they were perfectly natural in this setting. This was 100% something that they were like down to do. And it comes across like so many people, like so many critics at the time, like compared it to like the Marx Brothers and stuff. Like it seemed like a legitimate professional like comedy film with people that knew what they were doing, even though like they're just like a pop group. But that's the magic of the Beatles, that they really were more than that. Their persona was something that really had a whole lot to do with their success, and a whole lot to do with why people found them as people so endearing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it just seemed like they were having a good time.
Are there any lines in particular you like?
Oh my goodness, there's many. I really love George just in this, like how deadpan he is. I think he really works for comedy so well.
Yeah.
Like the one bit I really loved was when they have like the old guy in the cupboard, and Ringo goes in there and he goes, "Oh, you know, there's an old guy in the cupboard." And then like they don't think much of it, and then George just goes over to it, opens the door, sees him, closes it, walks back, and then just sits back down and goes, "You know, he's right, you know."
I love like the little scene. Pause too. Like it's like he sits down, he waits a second, and then goes like, "Oh, you know, he's right."
yeah, that's like, it. You know,
just perfect timing.
You know, I think George would like. I think he would really maybe this even started it, but he had like a knack for this too, and he actually got. It's funny you brought. I think you brought up Monty Python before because he became like a Monty Python producer.
Oh yeah,
he became a film producer later on.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, so like he had appearances in those. So he definitely like loved this kind of thing
for sure.
Too. So he definitely knew what he was doing when he was like putting in those like extra little pauses or whatever, mm-hmm. like to emphasize things. And like I said, I love Paul's grandfather character in this.
Such
like,
a ridiculous character.
Like him talking to Ringo in that scene where they tell Ringo that he has to look after him, and like yeah. he says the phrase that like that made me laugh, but I don't know what it quite means, but I think you can kind of infer when he talks about a pink edged daisy. You never. I was like, that's not a term, right? Like, it's just
there's a lot of unique slang. Yeah.
Slang and innuendos.
Yeah, I love
or whatever.
Ringo in this.
Yeah, yeah, Ringo's great, but Paul's grandfather. And I like how they just like he just shows up. He's like, oh, that's my grandfather.
He was that little old man.
Oh, it's just my grandfather. That's not your grandfather. Your grandfather lives with you. Oh no, that's my other grandfather.
Everyone's entitled to two.
Everyone has two. it's just fun.
Yeah, it's just like I said, it's like this effortlessly funny dynamic. Like I'm a big fan of the band dynamic and how they dunk on Ringo all the time, which is something that ended up being like a story element later in the movie where Ringo goes off on his own to find himself. But I love the I love the moment where like a bunch of fan mail comes in and at first, like, there's none for Ringo, and, like, they're all, like, kind of joking about that. Then a giant pile comes for Ringo, and John's like, must have cost you a fortune in stamps, Ringo. and George says something like, oh, it comes from a large family. Like oh, poor Ringo, man. Like he's, the idea was, like, you know, the band, like, none of them respect him, but, like, he's the favorite. You know, like, he gets all the fan mail. He gets, like all that, but
Oh wait, I do have something I want to say.
Sure.
And it's perfect that we save this for close to the end because I want to talk about the beginning.
Sure.
That very first scene, which is probably the sequence that most people know from this, if they have any knowledge of this movie at all, where they're getting chased by the giant crowd. Mm-hmm. That was a wild sequence where you have tons of people just following. It looked like the scene from the prison break scene from Hidden Fortress.
Yeah.
And like there's people like falling down and looking like they probably really hurt themselves too, but they just they could never make something like that now.
Yeah.
And I think even Ringo falls at some point, like right not Ringo, it was George, I think.
Yeah, in the
maybe
beginning,
George falls like right
George
at the beginning.
George falls over and it looks like he hurt himself, but he just gets back up and starts.
He gets right back
again,
up because he's got a giant crowd like behind him too. Like he's gonna get trampled. Yeah, that was a crazy sequence.
Yeah, that's probably the most, like, iconic sequence from the movie, just in general, just because of how, like, how perfectly that describes the Beatles phenomenon at the time, you know? And, like, you know, they're all getting chased by their fans and just, like, laughing and, like, enjoying it, but at the same time, they're, like, they're constrained by their fame. Like, their freedoms are starting to get, like, kind of limited because they can't go anywhere because they have so many fans. They have so many obligations, right? So there's a lot that goes into the story here and a lot that makes it really interesting and worthwhile from a lot of different perspectives, both as like somebody that's interested in the Beatles, but even if you're not, I really feel like this is just an excellent comedy film with a lot of interesting elements to it and a lot that ended up influencing so much stuff down the line. Like there's countless things that you can point to that started in A Hard Day's Night, like you know, the whole idea of the music video really was born here, if you think about it in a way. And apparently, like, Richard Lester was, like, given, like, a commendation from MTV or something for inventing the music video or whatever. So, yeah, it's really interesting. And I definitely would highly recommend that people check this out. It's beyond anything, it's just a good time. It's a really, really fun movie. And especially if you're into that sort of deadpan, like, British humor, I think this is up there with the best of them, honestly.